Deadwood Soundweb.
You have found Dirt Maps, a tributary to The Real War Project, a podcast about the narrative, affective, and production politics of war cinema. In today's episode, I talked to Dr. Lorenzo Veroncini, author of The Settler Colonial Present, about the differences between colonialism and settler colonialism, and the role of cinema in preserving and maintaining the legacies of settler colonial ideology. If you would like to find more Dirt Maps, look for The Real War Project. That's REEL War Project, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the show. Joining me now is Dr. Lorenzo Veroncini. Dr. Veroncini teaches history and politics at the Swinburne University of Technology, Melbourne. His research focuses on the comparative history of colonial systems. He's authored Israel and Settler Society, Settler Colonialism, A Theoretical Overview, The Settler Colonial Present, The World Turned Inside Out, and Colonialism, A Global History. He has also co-edited the Routledge Handbook of the History of Settler Colonialism, manages the Settler Colonial Studies blog, and was the founding editor of Settler Colonial Studies. Dr. Veroncini, thank you so much for taking your time to talk with me today, and welcome to The Real War Project.
Thank you for having me.
It's just a real treat to finally get to chat with you. You were on another podcast very recently that I listened to. It was the New Books Network podcast, and you described settler colonialism there as a mode of domination.
And I was wondering if you could start our conversation off today with a bit of an explanation about what the word mode means in that context.
I'm going to summarize here, but I hope I can make a point. So in my analysis, colonialism is an unequal relation. There are many. There's patriarchy, there's racism, there's capitalism. There are so many unequal relations. And colonialism is one of them. It is premised on violence, and it's premised on displacement, on moving from one location to another. But this is not the end of it, obviously. Colonialism, like imperialism, is often a very ambiguous umbrella definition. A lot falls within it. It's about subjection, but it's also about either or reproduction and elimination. We could spend a few hours talking about this, but basically they're not the same thing, and they articulate in various ways and at different times. So we have two stories that we can think about when we think about colonialism. One is when someone moves south to another place and by way of violent behavior, sort of organizes a plantation. And at the end of the day, they live in the White House on top of a hill, and they are enjoying a drink on the front porch of their house, and they're looking out and they're seeing down in the bottoms, and they're seeing people working for them. And when they are thinking about it, they think this is right. This is the way it should be. This, even the Bible says that this is the way it should be. And they think about the future, and they think that if the future should be right, their great-grandchildren will be in a house like his own, and the great-grandchildren of the people at the bottom will be exactly in the same position where they are. And so that mode of relation is unequal, and it's based on its reproduction. Basically, it's designed to reproduce itself. But another story we could tell is when someone is in a place, and then they move to another place, and they meet the people of the place, and then they suddenly realize that they are there. And their reaction is that they shouldn't be there, that they've got nothing for them, that they should go away. And if they have their way, at the end of the day, they build a nice cottage with a white picket fence at the front. And at the end of the day, they are enjoying a beer, and they are looking down, and they see at the end of the street some remnants of an indigenous population. They may live at the edge of town. And when they're thinking about the future, they think that their great-grandchildren should be in a cottage like his own, and the great-grandchildren of the people at the bottom of the street should just not be there, should have disappeared. And so you see, the second story is about eliminating a relation, not about reproducing it. That's why I'm I'm saying that there are various modality of colonialism, and we should understand their difference, because otherwise we use colonialism as a term in an ambiguous way. It's not satisfactory.
A lot of times when folks are trying to describe legacies of colonialism, what they're really describing is settler colonialism. And we tend to not name some of the key aspects of privilege and power that need to be interrogated. One of the follow-ups I wanted to ask you, still wrestling with this word, like it's a mode of domination. I see cinema invoked a lot as a form of storytelling. It too is a form of reproduction. You could argue elimination, I think. I don't know. How is cinema involved in this process?
It is. The stories we tell are so important. And cinema has rehearsed the story of settler colonialism so many times. And we will talk about the ways in which this has been done and what are the most essential features of these imbrications between this mode of domination and cinema. And I should also say that there is a significant scholarly literature dedicated to this imbrication. In my opinion, in my analysis, the basis for claiming that classic cinema may be considered as a quintessentially settler colonial medium are homology and surrogacy. Please give me a chance of explaining. So attention should be on the tropes and on representation. But if we concentrate on the mechanics of production as well, we can sense that film editing and settler colonialism operate in homologous ways. The camera settles, I'm using this term advisedly, on an image and elides everything else. Unwanted segments are cut away. Film editing is performed in many ways, from where exactly the camera is placed to what exactly is cut off from a particular take. But it is inevitably about what is deliberately left out, what is not seen. It is an act and a practice that covers its tracks, like settler colonialism is a mode of domination that programmatically erases the conditions of its operation. So settler colonialism also lies by way of editing. For example, editing relationships with indigenous sovereign collectives, populations that are to be assimilated or removed or targeted for elimination. And it elides complexities that are to be flattened and are all to be transferred and edited away in accordance with a logic of elimination. So editing is a normalizing practice in both contexts, cinema and settler colonialism. And that's my claim for thinking about the homology between the two. But there is surrogacy as well as homology. In a way, and in the context of imaginary, cinema has historically functioned in lieu of settler colonialism. After the closing of the settler colonial, please see my fingers, settler colonial frontier.
Large quotation marks.
Yes. Cinema can be seen as surrogate settler colonialism. Los Angeles and Hollywood came at the end of the global settler revolution. And when the political and imaginative traditions I've called the world turned inside out had entered a critical crisis, Los Angeles became cinema's global center in the crucial decades when settler colonialism as practice, even if not as structure, had entered a global crisis. It was a geographical and a chronological end at once. The ocean was in the way, a trope that has been rehearsed many, many times. I can think of many rehearsals of this trope about, angry men at the shore hating the ocean because it stopped them. And, the notion that in California things better work out because there is no further room for settler colonialism. So the sense that settler colonialism could no longer proceed as it previously had, and the idea that it was in Hollywood that a new post-settler world would merge, was widespread. So the crisis of settler colonialism was followed by classical cinema. So when the settling of the land ended, settler colonialism remained as a structure and as a projection, and I'm using projection advisedly. So a psychological projection is literally what one does when they run out of emotional space, and I'm using space also advisedly. So cinema is not settler colonialism. It is much more beyond a specific mode of domination and much more beyond the U.S. But Hollywood surrogated for settler colonialism after its end. and from where it ended, which is significant. So the global Great Land Rush ended in projection, a very real metaphor. And cinema, after all, is about projecting. And it's significant that early cinema was very much about representing the settler colonial stories and telling the story of settler colonialism. It's still one of the things that cinema does best.
You detail in The Settler Colonial Present, your chapters make a couple of just very basic claims about settler colonialism that are helpful. Settler colonialism is not colonialism. Settlers are not migrants. Settler colonialism is not somewhere else. And settler colonialism is not finished. These are all obviously really fundamental in terms of understanding how settler colonialism works, but I just wanted to pick particularly how settler colonialism is not colonialism, and how settler colonialism is not somewhere else. Do you want to maybe try to just unpack those a little bit for our listeners and describe what you mean by that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to say that I'm very grateful for your engagement with my work. Thank you. And yes, this query complements the previous one about different colonial modalities. Subjection for the purpose of reproduction is not the same as subjection for the purpose of its discontinuation. So they're actually one, the opposite of the other, the opposite ideal type. For example, if we have a story, a movie extolling colonialism, the movie will convey that subjection is natural, inevitable, and ultimately it's desirable. And so I'm thinking Gone with the Wind.
Ashley becoming home. We'll plant more cotton. Cotton ought to go sky high next year.
But on the other hand, a movie extolling settler colonialism will proceed by lasting indigenous people, you know, by telling the story of how they moved away, how they threw their final breath, how their dying pillow was moved. There are so many ways of how they became someone else, So let's focus on this. There is a difference between a story that forecasts its sequel.
Cotton ought to go sky high next year.
And there is no sequel after the last of the Mohicans. You know, there is lasting is final.
A warrior goes to you swift and straight as an arrow shot into the sun. They are all there, but one. I, Chingachgook, last of the Mohicans.
And so in this sense, colonialism and settler colonialism are antithetical because the fundamental stories that underpin their operation are different. But when it comes to the spatial organization of these modes, then we have to think how their difference impacts how we see what we see. So classically, you have the metropole and you have the colony, and they're not the same place, right? The classic imagery of colonialism is that there is a body of water separating them. And this idea of a blue water colonialism is so powerful. It's underpinning how the United Nations sees colonialism, right? Blue water has incredible consequences in terms of how the political geometry of colonialism operates. But with settler colonialism, it's different because metropole and colony are collapsed. The settlers travel with the metropole. They have a portable metropole that travels with them. They travels with their sovereignty. They establish their own sovereignty where they are. They deny the ongoing role of the other metropole.
But who empowered these colonials to pass judgment on England's policies in her own possessions and to come and go without so much as a by your leave?
They do not live their lives by your leave. They hack it out of the wilderness with their own two hands, burying their children along the way.
You are defending him.
And so space in settler colonialism is not disjoint, is actually right there. The space of colonialism is where it's happening, not in a blue water. So this is what I had in mind when I proceeded with that sort of distinction.
Most of what you read really does put the emphasis on the land and the way that the land operates with settler colonialism. I'm just not familiar with the blue water conceptualization of classic colonialism, but when you put the two of them in conversation like that, it makes a whole lot of sense. Really appreciate that. In the New Books Network podcast that I mentioned, you're discussing your book, The World Turned Inside Out. And you say that part of what you want to do is describe how the political imagination and fantasies, looking here again at cinema, of notions like masculinity and religion are understood within settler colonial frames. Can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean with regards to each of these?
Yes, I can. It's a shameless plug for my book.
It's a good book.
I've been reading for decades about people dreaming of new places where they could finally be themselves, their true selves. Where, you know, and they understood that they could not be their true selves where they were, that there were mounting contradictions where they were, and so they dreamt of other places. And so this is a remarkable archive. And in my work, I understand it as a tradition, as a literal tradition, because in this case, the collection of images, of imaginations, of stories is moved across space. So there is a literal tradition. And look, this is a very interesting thing when you read these stories, you know, side by side and together. For some reasons, all these people imagining new places, and there were so many, they all felt that change and revolutionary change where they were, the contradictions they were facing, were challenging their masculine. It's an interesting mechanism, but basically they felt that they had to go so that they could be not only their truest self, but their understanding of what a true man should be. So they were thinking about new places and obviously about what they would bring there, what they could bring with them in the new place. Basically, they thought that religion was a portable institution that they absolutely needed in the new place. And also they thought that the family, the patriarchal family, would be a portable institution they absolutely needed in the new place. They liked to travel light. They liked to think they were traveling light, but they needed religion and family for the masculinity they had in mind, for it to thrive in the new place, for it to be rescued from the old one. So this story is being rehearsed so many times, and cinema does rehearse it too.
In so many different ways. We just look at what we call affective structures, narrative structures, production politics. These are the kind of three ways that we go looking. And one of the narrative structures that we find again and again is what we call the cishet white settler patriarch. Most of what we have read links this ideology to notions like Jacksonian militarism. We don't want to say that the United States of America is the only settler colonial project, because it demonstrably is not. But Jacksonian militarism here seems to be a very particular brand of the lone pious father in the wilderness volunteering to fight a brutal war against hordes of vicious and, big quote, savage enemies. Does this kind of track with your consideration of these themes as far as what we've uncovered?
Look, Jacksonian militarism makes sense when you look at the history of settler colonialism. It sets an example, and there are plenty of settlers who thought that Jacksonian militarism wasn't the best way of doing settler colonialism. And they thought they had it, you know, they had better recipe for settler colonialism. I speak for Australia. Most of the settlers of Australia were horrified at Jacksonian politics. That's because they thought they were doing settler colonialism better. But anyway, that's a completely different story. I would add one further element to the string you mentioned, the cishet white settler. And that's narcissistic. The settler is self-centered. The settler's psychological disposition is profoundly narcissistic, because the way they see it, the whole universe is at stake when they have breakfast, right? They see that there's so much at stake in their own story. Because what they see is that they understand that the very possibility of reproducing a specific polity and a political order is at stake, and they are the only ones, right? So there's this narcissistic dimension to what they're doing, what they see themselves doing when they're doing what they're doing, right? And so, as a matter of fact, the settlers have a whole industrial behemoth behind, right? It's not a close call. You know, they got power. They perceive that they have nothing behind them, that they can't possibly go back, right? That the only way out is forward, and the whole universe is at stake, right? This is such an interesting psychological disposition. It's really unsettling. It's really weird in many ways. But it makes sense. It's a story we know, and it's a story that is continuously rehearsed. So I'm thinking, for example, I don't know if you had time. Have you watched 1883?
No.
The drama series. It's atrocious. But one of the episodes of this drama series is entitled "Behind Us, a Cliff," and that's the kind of disposition that the settlers have, and it's a well-known story. That's why it can be mobilized today. And by the way, the series is atrocious. It's but it is also a veritable collection of settler colonial tropes. So I could not stop watching it. It's not an endorsement, but if you're interested in how settler stories work, it's definitely an interesting one. So because of this disposition, this narcissistic, self-centered, and plus the idea that the whole universe is at stake and the only way out is forward, then you have genocidal fantasies and the acting on genocidal fantasies. But you don't understand genocide and the imagination of genocide unless you realize what particular psychology underpins the settler.
The narcissism note is well taken the other direction. There's a cliff behind us. We have to go forward. But in front of us is manifest destiny. In front of us is capital P progress, capital C civilization. They themselves will be very humble agents often, but will see the project itself as of the settler colonial state as something that is worth maintaining in very narcissistic ways, I think. Right?
It's a strange mind. I'm fascinated. By the way, I'm a settler, right? So there is some self-analysis here as well. But thinking that you're moving forward across space and at the same time moving backwards to a more genuine reality, and that you're moving to a place you have never been, and at the same time moving towards it's your place.
Yeah.
You know, the place that I've always waited for you. It's just uncanny.
It seems very natural when you see like Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman in Far and Away, but when you stop and say it out loud, it just gets real weird. And suddenly we have to reconsider a lot of, at least my history here on Wiat land and coming from Montana where I do. I want to jump ahead a little bit. You talk a lot about the kind of political imaginary, and we've mentioned cinema as a key role here. A friend of mine, Dr. Michael Lechuga, is about to release his book on what he's describing as alien affects, which he says emerge from the kind of intersections between border control agencies, cinematic production companies, and the public. In particular, he found several instances, but this one's really wild. The company that did the viewing special effects for the movie Predator did the visual interface for the Department of Defense for the Predator drone. It's the same corporation that is rendering alienhood both on screen and in border security spaces. And thus he describes this corporation and several others as having real fundamental roles to play in creating what he describes as the affects of alienhood. The public is a viewership. We are a policing agent. That's a big context build up for what he wanted me to ask you, which is, what is your favorite alien movie? And what do you think it says about settler colonialism?
Look, aliens are very important, right? And alienhood is about many things, but it's especially about projection, right? Because the real aliens in the story are the settlers, which, you know, they are people who move across space, right, to a place they've never been before. They think about aliens and at the same time, they think about themselves without telling themselves they're thinking about themselves. But thinking about aliens is a very pacifying story because if you are a settler, you know you are, and you know, the only way really you can become indigenous is if the aliens come, because you want the land of indigenous people. But also, if you are a settler, what you want is to enjoy the land as if you were indigenous, because no one likes to be an usurper. And and also because the narcissistic dimension of the settler psyche sort of invites them to think that they are the absolute best that humanity can possibly cobble together. So to short circuit this contradiction between being an usurper and the best ever, they need to think about aliens, right? They need to entertain the fantasy of someone coming, and that's an invasion, and that's what they've done. But they're facing, and that's they're indigenous, because the aliens are now the usurpers. And so alienhood is crucial to the settler's story, but it's also crucial to the way the settlers manage the contradictions of their own subject position. So your colleague is onto something.
Do you have a favorite alien movie?
Oh yes, the favorite alien movie. Okay. Sorry. Prey.
There's something out there. I'm coming with you.
You can't.
I'm trying to protect you.
Protect me from what?
Which is the latest installment of the Predator franchise, right?
He's going to be really excited that you said this. I have not seen it,
but he has so much.
Sorry, go ahead. I know, I'm behind. I'm late.
It was released in August 2022, right? So you're not that much.
You can say anything you want about it. Don't worry about spoiling a thing for me. I'm curious what, if anything, you think it has to say about settler colonialism.
I think that this is a movie about aliens, but it's not a settler colonial movie about aliens. So I'm praising it in contradistinction from, you know, a bunch of other movies about aliens. So it is about a violent alien invasion. I mean, and the invader is driven by a logic of elimination, right? It is not an indigenous production, but it can be seen, in my opinion, as a decolonial movie. It's a big budget film by Native Americans rather than about Native Americans. And first of all, there is no lasting, right? The indigenous people do not die at the end, do not move on. And second, there are no indigenous psychics or appropriation. It's especially interesting because there are other invaders too in the story. They are encroaching on indigenous territory and they speak French, have firearms and kill indiscriminately. There are other things that make the movie really compelling. That the hero of the story is a woman. She has remarked on the cultural accuracy of the movie, and on the deliberate intention to avoid boiling indigenous people down to something one dimensional. The producer is Comanche, and her role in the making of the movie was crucial, not that of a cultural consultant who could be overridden, but you know. Also, the script was adapted when needed. And then most importantly, the movie was formally screened to the representatives of the Comanche Nation. And it was done before the movie was finished. So they had a say in the final product. So in a way, this is what cinematic sovereignty looks like.
And it's so complex that it's sitting there in the Predator franchise. This is one of the reasons he's so excited about it, because when you link that franchise to the Predator drone, the implications of how, you know, his term alien affects work to maintain settler colonial visions of alienhood just really explode. Let's return briefly to some of the work that you've written in the book Cinematic Settlers. You contributed a chapter here. You look at what you call settler evasions in the film Interstellar and Cowboys and Aliens, another one that I should have seen for my research that I have not yet. But I would really love, I read the article, I thought it was great. Could you describe for the audience like what you mean by evasion? My guess is it sounds very much like this process that we describe often as like active forgetting, whereby settler colonial societies commit to reimagining the past in a way that just completely erases their culpabilities. You've spoken quite a bit about this already. Is that what we're describing here?
We all know that settlers invade indigenous land, but the reverse of this invasion is the evasion that they perform by moving out of their locations. So evasion is also what settlers do. They evade contradictions, they evacuate locations, they evade responsibilities. And in my work, I always thought that we should keep invasion and evasion in mind together, jointly, simultaneously. And evasion allows us to understand how settlers tell stories. Because if you are an invader, you will tell the history of an invasion in a particular way. But if you need to neglect the invasion, then telling about evasion is important. You know, you tell, oh, I was so downtrodden in another place. That's why I left. Yeah, but tell us about the invasion. Oh, it was so downtrodden. I had no choice. I had to leave. Right? But you are an usurper. Oh yeah, but I was so downtrodden, and how could a man be a man if they couldn't possibly raise a family? But what did you do to indigenous people? Oh, but look what they did to my ancestors, and how important. You know what's that? That's an evasion.
Dunbar Ortiz famously says, "We celebrate the 4th of July without a hint of tragedy in the United States. Absolutely none. And if you bring it up on the 4th of July, shame on you for being political on this holiday." We're going to dodge quite a bit in the settler colonial present. Again, you talk about the need to maybe stop dodging and start unsettling settler colonialism everywhere. And you have described yourself as having an autonomous political perspective. And I'm curious if these two ideas are related.
Okay, so talking about evasions, I am a settler, but I'm also an immigrant to a settler society. That's a distinction. Immigrants move across space, but they don't move towards their country. They move towards someone else. And personally, I should also say that my personal story won't end in settlement. I will go back. I won't stay here. I'm here for work. So I'm a settler. There is no doubt about it. I live on indigenous land and I benefit from the dispossession of indigenous sovereign nations. But a settler is not everything that I am. I believe that I am made by settler colonialism as much as by movement. Therefore, that settler colonialism can be undone, and that a settler without settler colonialism is not a settler, is something else. And I'm seeking these decolonizing move. And I also think that knowing about the stories settlers tell themselves about and others about themselves, and a critical ability to contest these stories' hegemony is a crucial part of a decolonial practice. So that's how I see my work. And finally, but very importantly, I pay the rent, which is probably an Australian thing to do. But, you know, if you pay the rent, the place is not yours. And settlers realizing that the place is not their own, it's a very important step. Again, paying the rent could be seen as an evasion of sort, but there are less productive ways of evade.
I think in a world where our go-to is very elaborate evasion, naming and owning the stories that we are responsible for is a substantial movement in the right direction. And here, there's lots of ways you can pay the rent. There's the WIAT honor tax where folks can pay like monthly or weekly or whatever contribution you want to make. You can make all sorts of ways you can contribute to giving the land back wherever you are in terms of donating homes that you do purchase or inherit or things like that. Are these kind of all in line with what you mean in terms of what it takes to resist settler colonial realities in our lives?
Yes. Okay. I should also say that a tax is what defines sovereignty, right? So paying the rent, it's not just about a transaction. It's also a recognition of unsurrendered sovereignty. You know, if our societies are made by land being stolen, a land tax will undo it. There are other ways of resisting the settler colonial reality that shapes our life. One important decolonial story we must begin telling is that even though settlers think that they are the end of history, there is nothing beyond settler colonialism. That the settlers can evade history and the contradictions and go to a place where there's no history, there's no further story. I do not think that settler colonialism is the end of history or even necessary. Indigenous polities survive, the settlers run away, but contradictions catch up. they dream of masculinity is restored somewhere else, but end up devastating environments, becoming indebted, decultured in horrible isolation. So we got to start telling this, that this is not the end of the story, that there is a lot beyond it, and also that a post-settler colonial world is going to be a better place, than the one that settler colonialism built. That, you know, giving back land is not about doing without something or renouncing to something for ethical reason. We are actually embracing a better future. And indigenous sovereignty is one way in which we can undo a world that is underwhelming. We can do better. We can do beyond settler colonialism. We can turn ourselves into non-settler people. That we can do this. We got this.
The stories, at least, can be so much more interesting. We get so tired of the same hero, and we get a different hero, and all of a sudden the movie is really interesting.
Yeah. but we can also say that that way of doing masculinity is dissatisfying.
Yes.
We can do better humans and better masculinities, yeah, than that. That is a very low bar.
It is a very low bar. Okay. Just two more questions if you do have the time. You've contributed not only to the literature on settler colonialism, but also various summaries of this literature, looking at how numerous theorists have grappled with this concept as you kind of contribute your own work here. We are noting, as we study alien movies, they are just all bringing us back to settler colonialism. And science fiction, too. Just science and fiction. These words paired together tend to imagine a kind of future that will probably be inherently colonized, if not settler colonial. And I'm wondering, I know that science fiction has always been important for critical theory, but I'm wondering if this emphasis on settler colonialism from our perspectives is new. How has this been looked at over time?
Settler colonialism and science fiction go way back, just like cinema and settler colonialism go way back. Because if settler colonialism is underpinned by imagining places that are others, then that's the business of science fiction, right? The settlers leave their world, but in science fiction, you actually leave this world, like literally. Unfortunately, though, for some reason, there hasn't been a settler colonial studies turn in the study of science fiction. So there is something I wanted to add to this. Thinking about aliens is crucial because one of the results of this is alienation, right? Alienation and naturalization are two sides of the same coin, right? The settler naturalizes by alienating others, and obviously alienation is also a psychological disposition. So this line of inquiry should probably be pursued. But by comparison, I should say that colonialists think about others. You know, there's a distinction there by between the other and the alien, right? The other can be in the same place, and his alterity is irredeemable. But the alien is from somewhere else. There is a displacement there that sort of rules coexistence in the same place out. And so in a sense, the distinction between alienation and othering is the distinction between settler colonialism and colonialism as distinct modes of subjection. I hope it makes sense.
It absolutely makes sense. And again, it really does make me think of, and it's not just because he's a friend of mine. I think it is a very smart idea to talk about alien affects as a kind of vision, a settler colonial vision. And he describes alien affects as things that are generated by the way that we visualize bodies, and bodies shimmer with alienhood. The universe does not care what an alien is. It very much is about who are you and how do I see this other person coming and where are they coming from? So I really do appreciate that examination, and it speaks to kind of what we're finding. So I appreciate that. Last question here, and it could be a big one. What are you reading right now that's making you think? Are you working on anything new that you'd like to share with our listeners to get them looking for what's next?
Sure. I think I've got another book, and that's it, right? So I'm working on digital colonialism, and especially on the digital natives. Please consider the meaning of, you know, digital natives, because we all know what happens to the natives, right?
Yeah.
I see a striking homology between the ways in which indigenous peoples were dispossessed of their estates and the ways in which the territories we collectively build and curate online are becoming appropriate. Mm. So that will take a few years, but that's what I've been thinking. That's what I've been reflecting on.
It makes plenty of sense. I really appreciate it, and I will be looking forward to it. Dr. Veranchini does teach history and politics at the Swinburne University of Technology, Melbourne. His research focuses on the comparative history and colonial systems. He's authored and edited numerous texts. He manages the Settler Colonial Studies blog and was the founding editor of the Settler Colonial Studies. Dr. Veranchini, thank you so much for taking your time to talk with me today.
Thank you. That's fun.
This has been an episode of Dirt Maps, a tributary to The Real War Project, a podcast about the narrative, affective, and production politics of war cinema. If you would like to find more Dirt Maps, you can look for The Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.
Check out all the content brought to you by Redwood Sound Labs. Listen to the new show that will help you live a better life with your beloved pets. It handles topics like proper food, nutrition, positive reinforcement training, and more. Certified dog behavior consultant Charlotte Peltz welcomes your pet concerns and questions in Living with Your Dog. Zach and Matt are two veteran horror movie enthusiasts discussing their favorite and not so favorite films. Spoilers abound, so scary movie fans beware. Watch no evil. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient and cinematographer. Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, effective, and production politics of war cinema on The Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. You can find all these shows wherever you find podcasts.